Why am I muted?
You got me waiting in the lobby.
I didn't mute myself.
Yeah, you did.
Why would it start off pre-muted?
Are you implying that's
the dumbest thing I ever?
Are you talking about prior restraint? Are you saying that I muted you?
I'm talking about institutional capture.
Uh-huh.
Is what I'm talking about.
Yes.
I sign on to this dumb thing. You're there with your blue man.
Let's keep it between the lines, Johnny. Institutional capture, institutional kill.
Yeah, I didn't. Well, maybe I didn't mute. I'm not a muter.
Please, I'm not a muter. You're a muter. Your father was a muter. Your mother was a muter.
That's not true.
You're coming from a long line of muters.
That's not true. We came to this clean country.
You came to me. I'm in my slick suit. You're telling me you're not a muter?
We didn't mute anything. Are you serious? You think I would mute myself?
Let me tell you. I do see the irony. Okay. All right. Let's keep the bit going for another 20 seconds. Anyway, you came here to this clean country, you know? So, you know what? We're both part of the same mutation.
Yeah.
But never say anything about my family.
Sometimes computers are great. I just was sitting here. You bleeped me. I put it on.
I didn't bleep you. Wait, now you're saying I censored you?
No, you booped. You booped me.
I don't know if you've learned
me.
God damn it, John. I don't know if you've learned the new system. I don't know if you've learned the new system, and I have.
I bookmarked it.
Now, Dan makes a new link for every episode, so I have to wait for Dan to send me a link every time.
I know he doesn't. You know, this morning,
I told him 6 weeks ago, Dan, you know you can go, like I've done with John, you know you can go and make that permanent. He says, yeah, I'll do that. I'm not trying to mute Dan, and I'm not trying to come in and despoil this clean country.
No.
I woke up this morning
with a little bit of a, you know, for the last.
You woke up with a ZZ Top song?
That was you. For the last few days, I've been fighting. I don't know whether it's an allergy or what. And as I was sitting here right before you booped me,
oh boy,
I was thinking, you know, more than a handful of times, Dan canceled our show
as it was happening
for less reason.
Yeah.
Than that, you know, like,
you had to get lunch. Sick. Get a prescription lunch.
I'm sick and I can't do the show. People won't like it because they won't like to hear my voice less than perfect.
Uh-huh. No. He has to pick up his prescription lunch from lunch school.
It's 12. What are you supposed to do at 12?
What time do you eat? You can't just cancel lunch.
You can't have lunch at 11:45 and you can't have it at 12:15.
And you can't go swimming with a water buffalo. Yeah. You can't go skating in a watermelon patch. How does it go? Remember the song?
Yeah, you can't take the mask off. Old Lone Ranger.
Oh yeah, you don't met spitting into the wind. Yes, there were a lot of songs about admonitions in the 60s and 70s. I was thinking of the great Roger Miller, whom my father really enjoyed. We had an 8-track of Roger Miller's greatest hits that I grew up with.
You know, I have that picture of your dad, and I can imagine him sitting there listening to Roger Miller. It's a perfect little.
Sailors for sail or rent. He ain't got no cigarettes. You understand?
I was watching. some Jimmy Reed the other day, and thinking, That's what I was thinking.
I'm spacing out because what? He's not the brakeman. He's not the yodeler. Who's Jimmy Reed?
Oh, he's the brakeman yodeler.
I knew it was either that or the guy from the Just Like Honey song, the Scottish band. Which is different from the Scottish play. No, yeah. Jesus, isn't there a Reed? Aren't there two Reeds in...
Imagine Wagons. Yeah, there are two Reeds in an oboe.
Imagine Wagons. Exactly. Dance of Wance of Wagons. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, sure.
You got Jim Reed, and then you got Joe Reed. And the two of them, they're in that song, the Jesus and Mary Chain, right?
Well,
Jimmy Reed
exceeded my depth.
Yodeling,
you're at where the swimming pool says 5 feet, and then 6 feet, and then 9 feet or whatever. You're always out in 9 feet.
John Roderick, what's your depth?
Standing back at 5 feet.
That's the nice thing about a pool. You can pick your depth.
I go lean on the wall. I put my elbows up. Don't put myself on mute. I just sit there, sunglasses on. The little bowl of spaghetti floating by. It's summertime, so I'm getting ready. I'm thinking about it. I see.
You're getting your swimsuit bod ready. Mm-hmm. That's the nice thing about a pool is you can do whatever you want in a pool up to a point. You know, they call it a swimming pool, but that's more of a serving suggestion. Who just gets in a pool and swims? Like, what are you, 60? You know?
Some people, yeah, that's right. 60-year-olds.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just picking out numbers. They're meaningless at this point.
Whenever I pack a suitcase, I always put a swimsuit in there. And then when I get back from the trip, I always take the completely dry, still folded, unused swimsuit out and put it back in the drawer.
That is very interesting to me.
My swimsuits go with me all around the world, but I try as hard as I can not to use them.
A breaking case of emergency type situation? I bought a brand new swimsuit for our recent trip across the pond, the other pond, and
it's a brand new swimsuit. It's Imagine Wagons. Yeah.
Oh, wow. You know what? You're on today. I like this. I like this, John. You either slept or didn't sleep is my guess.
Yes.
Not only is it still in the away suitcase from the trip from a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, it still has the tags on it.
Oh, you didn't? Wait a minute. You were in a beachy beach, and you didn't use your new swimsuit at all?
This surprises you?
Wow, it doesn't surprise me, but I'm very
impressed. It's okay if it surprises you, because it should surprise anybody who doesn't know me, but people who are...
No. Now I see that you are based, my friend.
I am stick man. I watched an entire season of Taskmaster in one day in our Airbnb.
Doom.
That's my idea of a vacation.
Kaboom.
Ever told you my definition of a vacation?
Just being in your room and nobody knocks on the door?
That's perilously close. I mean, if I had to do it as like one line, it would be that for me, anything can be a vacation if... the oversimplified way to put it is that nobody has any expectations of me.
Yes, that's nice.
And I understand that other people differ, but, you know, a lot of people differ about a lot of things, I've told you a couple things about this, because there's always two things with me. One is that I'm telling you today, as I think, that you come into this clean country, it's difficult for me to think of something as quote-unquote a vacation if it is just as saddled with expectations of me, or this is really important and this is what makes it complicated, or my feeling that there are expectations of me. Because I don't know if you draw a distinction there, but I sure do. Because my brain will be scanning the horizon. If I went anywhere I've evolved a lot as a traveler, for better or for worse. But one thing is, I used to be like, oh my God, for weeks, I would be like, okay, and just a final reminder that I won't be here on this Tuesday and that Tuesday, but I will be, you know what I mean? That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, just so you know, you're going to get an auto response because I'm not here. And still, I would be like, I just know there's a grenade rolling around somewhere. And on top of it, there's a general plan to do something today, and I don't know what and what to wear and what kind of sunscreen, and will there be shade and water there?
Yeah.
You know, that's not a vacation to me. That's, I don't know, what's the old phrase Tim Goodman used to use about TV, big TV events? He called it a death march with cocktails. That's kind of what other people call a vacation to me is a death march with cocktails. And by the way, that is what you get on a cruise ship. Just cute.
Oh, it is. Well, with gravy.
And gravy, and you do get soft serve. See, it's complicated.
We just did this trip where we spent 4 days in London, and then we went to Berlin for 4 days.
Four days
in London, it was obvious what we were going to do every day because we had all these things to do. We had to go to Westminster Abbey. We had to go to the Harry Potter thing. We had to go to the British Museum and see the Rosetta Stone.
Wait, the play?
We went to see Six, the West End musical.
The Wives of Henry VIII. My kid loves that musical.
That's right.
Was it good?
We went to see it in London. It was good. It was really good.
In it.
And my kid, I did not know this going in. My kid knew all the words.
Oh, my God. My kid has so much secret music.
Yeah, what are you doing over here?
Okay, I'm writing that down because I want to talk about secret music. I am actively very frustrated with my kid right now about this.
About secret music.
But did you... So, wait. So, you went... You saw Six. Oh,
We did all these things. We went to Tower of London. And so, every morning when we woke up, I knew what my job was. My job was to make all this happen. And it was obvious that we were going to have to do these things in a certain order.
Is it possible at this point you're a facilitator and full-time project manager for your quote vacation?
Well, so the managing falls to my daughter's mother by affinity, right? She wants to be managing it. She has it all.
She's good at it and she cares about the outcome. Why would she not be the one organizing it?
Right. So I'm the implementation agent. where it's just like, okay, now you get us all there.
That sounds like such a terrible euphemism for something. It depends on the decade when you're using that term. What did you say?
Implementation agent? That's pretty dangerous, right? But so it's just like, you get us to here, and then once we're there, get us through it, and then get us out of there, and then on to the next thing. And, you know, and we're fighting jet lag, which I also have a real system about, like, and that system is death march on the first day. Quit your complaining, because tomorrow you're going to thank me.
You know whether you like it or not. I might be projecting here, but you know whether you like it or not that the first day, from the time you arrive, at least 24 hours are going to be kind of useless. But that's, you accept that and then power on, or like, what is the rule of law inside the implementation agent's room?
When you land in Europe from the west coast of America, whatever time of day you land, you cannot go. You can go to the hotel or whatever and drop your bags off, but you cannot sit in a comfortable chair until 9 o'clock at night.
So do you immediately start acting like your body is on the current time? Is that the idea?
You have to, but you can't.
Really? So you're saying, like, again, to speak of pools, you're throwing your body, and there's a lot of actual science about this, about what happens to your body with jet lag. It's really interesting and very complicated. Short version, your different organs think they're in completely different time zones, and it takes a while for your body. No, seriously, different systems in your body, sleep being one, is that it's not a system technically, but you know what I mean. But you're saying you splash a little cold water on your face and you go straight up to the Towers of London.
That's right. And you cannot, whatever you do, you cannot think that it's a good idea to take a 5-minute nap, because it's not. It's just, you have to. And so
you're one of those folks who feels like you take that 5-minute nap. A, it might be a lot longer than 5 minutes, and B, you're going to wake up worse on the other side.
Yeah, it's all over. It's all over.
It's like so drinking salt water.
At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you've never been more tired, and then it's 5 o'clock, and you've never been more tired. But you can see in the distance, like, but if at 5 o'clock you're as far away from your hotel as you can be, then you know that
it's very much in my yellow zone, just so you know.
You have to get
pretty close to my red zone, just FYI. Right?
I know, it's terrible. but then so London was a great success, because I was given a list of things that we had to do, and I was told to keep the dragons away or whatever while we were doing them, and I was successful at that. But then we got to Berlin, and Berlin is in this little group, Berlin is my town, right? I've been to Berlin a lot. I mean, I've been to London a lot, but I've been to Berlin a lot. And I have feelings about what we should do in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And in London, I don't really have feelings, because how do you have feelings about what to do in London? You do the things in London. Well,
I mean,
as somebody
who's been to London, I think once, very briefly. I mean, I think a fair amount about London as a thing. Which London? You have so many. I mean, are we talking about the Roman times? Are we talking about Carnaby Street in it? Like, there's a lot of different Londons that you can. There's a lot has happened in London, John.
But this is the London where you have 4 days and you're traveling with a 13-year-old. Oof. And one of those days is devoted to going up to BFE to go through this Harry Potter, like hellscape. It's basically like Toy Story 3, except Harry Potter. And you're one of the toys.
Wait a minute. Are you talking about the live experience?
We went to the studio where they made Harry Potter, which they have decked out as a fun ride.
Oh, it's like, I know they do this with Doctor Who. There's a thing they call the Doctor Who experience, which is like a whole thing. It's kind of like a museum. Is it sort of like that? They've got like a whole thing you can go visit, like a Universal Studios kind of thing?
Yeah, they have all the original sets.
Oh my gosh,
so
really?
You're in the sets.
You could be in potions class. That's so cool.
All that stuff, but it's set up to funnel 15,000 people a day through there, mm-hmm. and they do it really well. It's genius,
designed by Temple Grandin.
But it's very much like, whoa! And if you want to be somebody who stops and reads every caption like I do, you could be in there for 6 weeks.
Sure, that's why you need a time turner.
Or if you want to be like my kid who does the Griswold at everything, like boom!
Right.
So, but anyway. In Berlin, there are, again, many Berlins, mm-hmm. just as you say, Do you want to go to Ye Olde Berlin? Do you want to go to, you know, Weimar Berlin? Do you, everybody wants to go to Hitler Berlin. Do you want to go to Russian Berlin? Do you want to go to what Berlin do you want?
Right.
Do you want to go to U2's Berlin? And I have a feeling like, oh, well, and the thing was, I was there in 89. So I have these weird memories of like, wait
before
a minute.
Or after,
I was,
before or after the wall?
Well, so both.
Jesus.
And I couldn't put it together. This was really weird to me. And I was driving yesterday thinking, I don't mind getting old, but I cannot start to have, you remember a year ago or whatever when I wasn't getting any sleep and I started to not be able to finish my stories?
I do remember that, yeah.
Yeah, where I was just like, what was I saying?
Something was taking away your instrument.
I was not, you know, I hadn't slept for weeks. Anyway, I'm there and I'm, you know, the big radio tower in East Berlin, the big spiky one with a ball on the top. It's like iconic East European 60s architecture. It towers over Berlin to this day. And we went up into it. You know, there's a rotating restaurant in it.
Oh, wow.
We went up there and I was walking around going, I came to this tower when it was in East Berlin, and I had dinner here, and I remember distinctly the whole restaurant was full of like East German apparatchiks, you know, like high-ranking members of the party, all in gray suits with brown ties.
like Stasi-adjacent people?
Well, just like
I guess everybody was Stasi adjacent by a certain point.
But this was the ruling class. This was the most expensive place in East Berlin in a time when there was, you know, it was arguably a communist economy. So what does expensive even mean? All pigs are equal. Mm-hmm. And I had this very clear memory. I was here in this restaurant with long hair, shit-faced, absolutely blotto, and eating... and ordering every steak on the menu, and everyone in the restaurant was glaring like the ugliest Eastern European glares.
Oh, I bet you were like the Anjin-sama.
I don't know what an Anjin-sama is.
Oh, sorry. You know, like the pilot in Shogun. Like you probably actually did.
Oh, the barbarian.
Well, yeah, and by the later episodes, he's walking around, like I was saying to Matt, like he really does kind of look like a barbarian. I bet that was you. You were like a Yeti with steaks.
And I was clearly from the West, and how did I get in here? And I'm sitting
laughing too loud, that kind of thing.
And I'm thinking to myself, how did I get in here? What am I making this up? This sounds like one of those things that, you know, to put it in the words of my daughter, this sounds like one of those things that daddy says that how is it, A, possible, and B, how could you possibly confirm this? Confirm or deny, you know, like, oh, I was here in 1989, months before the wall came down.
And fair to say, you were kind of a little drunk a lot then?
Oh, so drunk all
but
the time.
But also we know the curse of John Roderick is, at least in the story, I have no way to prove this, but you you say you... Part of your curse as a heavy drinking man was you could and would drink a lot, but you also tended to remember things that a lot of people would forget. You didn't
blacked out, just always just plodding along. Like,
are you able to,
like,
do you know roughly the dates and stuff? I mean, not that it would matter, but.
Well, so I have all my journals from that trip in 1989, except when I got my bag stolen in Avignon. The one journal that was in the bag when the bag was stolen was, and I lamented it at the time, when the bag was stolen, I said in the next journal that I started that day, the one thing I wanted out of that bag was my journal. They could have everything else. They could take everything I own. I just want that journal back. And I searched the garbage cans of Avignon for 4 days looking for the book, because it was like, at the time, the thing I was the most proud of I'd ever done. I'd been keeping this journal, and it was, you know, this book just sort of meant everything.
And the book, gone. For that reason, the entries in it ended there, but I'm guessing started and covered quite a lot of other distance that represented an important time in your life.
Well, and I had already completed two journals on this trip around Europe. And then this was journal three, where I really hit my stride as a writer and as a
journalist. You said 89. This is 10 years before the walk,
yeah. Right?
And so and also 10 years before you, like, we were robbed in, what, Czechoslovakia?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So that's the problem. In my head, I think I'm, because those both end in a nine, I don't know if the listener will have the same struggle. But just to clarify, this is not the time John took his long walk from Milan to Minsk. And this is 10 years earlier when you were drinking, as opposed to 10 years later when you weren't drinking. We took a long walk and your shoes fell apart and you got German underwear and saw a lady in a Dutch window. This is totally 10 years before, and you're an Anjin Sama Yeti eating mini steaks in a tower.
Yeah, I'd gotten kicked out of Gonzaga. For those of you following along.
Yeah, bring us up to speed, John.
Previously on John Roderick.
I'd gotten kicked out of Gonzaga and I couldn't, you know, and they had said, don't come back.
Yeah.
Right? We're not
going to... They call it the Jesuit goodbye.
Yeah. We're not going to put all these black marks on your transcript if you agree just not to come back. And I was like, I agree.
Is that the second time that's happened in an educational institution? Is that kind of what happened in high school too, a little bit?
It happens a lot. Yeah, right. It was what happened in high school. Yeah. They were like, look,
we'll just... I wrote it down here. As long as I don't lose it, I've got it written down here.
We're going to agree that you go, and then that'll be fine.
Okay, here's what we've decided, and you've agreed to.
We're not going to cheat. It's not called cheating if everybody agrees, right? And so I had some money because of the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend that they paid you every year to be an Alaskan.
What the?
I'll look it up. I said, look, I'm not going back to college, obviously, so I'm going to go to Europe instead. And I went over on Bastille Day, the 200th anniversary of Bastille Day. And I spent 9 months over there.
July 14th?
Hitchhiking around and dicking around and went all over.
Is that July 14th?
July 14th.
Okay.
And at one point, a couple of friends and I, we met a guy in Amsterdam who said, you guys want some Eurail passes? Eurail passes being these month-long passes that allow you to take any train
in Europe. I've heard about these since I was a kid. You buy one ticket and you can get on, for practical purposes, any train anywhere.
Any train. That's right.
To go, and you can just decide, okay, today we're going to Belgium.
You get regular class. You could get first-class Eurail passes. You could get a three-month Eurail pass, all this kind of stuff. And this guy, you know, I was just like sleeping in youth hostels and squats and whatnot. And this guy was just some, you know, street weirdo. But we were like, yeah, Eurail passes. And he actually came through with these three forged Eurail passes for me and my two friends. And they both got like student class 1 month Eurail passes. And he hands me a 3 month first class Eurail pass. Jesus. For the same, but we paid him 50 bucks or 50 gilda or whatever. Anyway, I'm here with my family in this East German tower. I can see the brown suited people with their weird Erich Honecker haircuts.
Oh, and do they have those rectangular eyeglasses like German?
Yeah, the rectangular, exactly.
Those are so German.
And I'm sitting there just like lotto drunk, hair in my eyes, going, how the hell am I remembering this? And I can't, I'm now in a world where I have to start calling people. And so I called my friend Peter in New York. I'm sorry, in Alaska. And I said, look, I got to know. Did we go to East Germany together in July of 1989? And he wrote back and said, we didn't go to Germany together at all. And I said, I'm pretty sure.
If I remember correctly, a pretty durable. Who's the guy you went to see Lola with at the strip club?
That's Peter.
So Peter's like a long, like as Alaska friends go, like Peter, you got a long history with Peter, right?
I do. And Peter says, well, look, it's not very clear to me because we were really drunk then. You need to ask Dolph, because Dolph remembers everything. Well, Dolph was Peter's roommate at Cornell, Adolphus Busch Orthwine III.
Related to?
The Anheuser-Busch family.
Uh-huh.
You've heard of Dolph before.
I've talked feel like these are some names we haven't talked about in a while, which I have long to time. Say is exactly sort of concomitant with what you're talking about, which mm-hmm. And I won't bring it up now, but like this is something I think about a lot too, which is a weird thing that happens where a memory, if you like, the easiest way to put it is a memory gets unlocked and you're suddenly like, wait a minute, there's this whole room in here that I haven't looked at in a long time. And there's some of it that feels so absolutely true. I know what order it happened in. Do you know what I'm saying? Those kinds of memories where you're like, and I have a recent instance last week of this happening to me where it's like things that happen. I know I'm talking to, in this case, five people about something that happened in 1989. And we can, none of us have thought about it in years. And we suddenly all see it crystal clear. We all remember it happening mostly in the same order. And then we collaborate on the sort of like what happened in this instance. And so you need to go, so you're, because of the nature of you unlocking this, if I could say, you're bringing up some names from back in our history. If it seems like I'm dwelling on it, I just want to make sure our listeners, you know, are caught up on the fact that this is actually a kind of John multiverse event we're talking about here. We're talking about many times, many peoples, and then we have the extra element of time on top of time, because now it's been 30 plus years since then, and you got to go talk to a Bush heir.
35 years.
Jiminy.
So Pete gives me Dolph's number, and I text Dolph. Hey, Dolph, I haven't talked to you in 30 years. How's it going? <What's up? clears throat> Did we ever go to East Berlin together in July of 89? And Dolph writes back and says, hey, man, I can confirm that we did not go to Berlin. Peter and I were in Berlin, and we sent a postcard to your mom telling her to tell you that we were going to Berlin and you should meet us there, but you didn't show up. And so I was like, right, that's how things were done then. And I must have called home and my mom said, Peter Nosek says to meet him in Berlin in July. And I was like, oh, I can't. I was somewhere else. Although I had very real memory of it, of being there, but it must have been some memory of thinking about doing it. So then so at this point, you know, my family is like, can we leave, Dad? Like, can we go?
But in troubleshooting that, you're partly it's you're competing with multiple memories, which your memory's pretty good about this kind of stuff. I mean, do you feel like it was a memory that got misfiled, or it's not something that you like hallucinated happening, but were you able to reach some level of confidence about what quote actually happened?
Well, so this is the problem, right? Because we were that whole era of my life, I was just drunk and high all the time, and also doing a ton of stuff. I wasn't just sitting drunk playing video games. Like, I'm drunk and high, but I'm hitchhiking from Portugal to Belgium, right? So I have a ton of memories that are just like in this thicket, but the glue that's holding it together after 35 years is starting to get yellow. The glue that it was all like, the events are just starting to come kind of not apart, but I couldn't figure out how I would.
Is it possible they no longer make sense on their own? Because one loses, at least for myself, I lose some of the cues that used to exist just naturally of like, oh, of course this happened and that happened. And of course it wouldn't have been that time because I wasn't into dinosaur yet. Or, you know, you have those weird memories where you're like, or I had this car at that time, or how did I get to Tampa that day? Right. Where you know there's things, but the glue you're talking about, the sort of temporal spackle that gives you confidence that this is actually an integrated story with continuity starts to get a little frustrating. And you need cues to like, say to yourself, now, wait a minute, something about this doesn't quite add up, right?
So after I get back to the States, I'm still chewing on this, because here's the problem. I was also traveling with Pat and Joe, two other guys, Pat being a friend from Gonzaga, Joe being his high school best friend. And we did go to Berlin in November of that year, and we were there for the wall coming down, and we did go through the border. You know, this was the time they had, it was, we were there, the wall came down on November 9th, and we were there on the evening of November 10th, right? So there were still kids on top of the wall. They had only pulled one little section out. People, you know, the Trabants were lined up at Checkpoint Charlie, and it was a madhouse, and like a great, one of the great events, right? And we did at that point then go through a legit checkpoint, because you couldn't just go, you know, there were guards all in those.
And the way I heard it is it all happened very, very fast, and might have even, quote unquote, kind of started because of an accident. Like, hadn't some kind of an announcement been made? Maybe I'm thinking of Glasnost. But I know this is a weird time where people were like, where it kind of happened fast, and they got over their skis a little bit. And then pretty soon it was like, oh, yeah, this is all just ending now. Now we're all just, this is something we all just have to accept. Now this is ending. And
yeah, the nation of Hungary had said, okay, we're going to loosen restrictions and we're going to let people cross.
Mm-hmm.
And then the people in Berlin were like, us too? And the German government was like, no, but. And as soon as they said but.
Yeah, right.
It was just like, woohoo! And
we're going to Disney World.
Yeah, once the first person had climbed on top of the thing and hadn't been shot, then there were 4,500 people sitting on the top of the Brandenburg Gate.
Right.
And the, you know, and so, and we were, we'd been.
But when normal order kind of clears up the next day, you can't just, one does not simply walk into East Germany. You still had to get like checked out.
As an American, I wasn't going to just like, hey, excuse me, coming through. You know, it was like, it was a madhouse, but there were still East German guards everywhere. And we had gone through the wall officially at that point and were on the other side to witness the chaos from that side. But even then, I knew I had been here before. I'd been to East Berlin before. So I'm here at home, and I think, I haven't talked to Patrick McComb, my college roommate. I haven't had to talk to him in 35 years either. And Pat had gone on to live a respectable life. He'd become a banker and lived in San Francisco, and eventually like didn't want to talk to anybody from college anymore because he had left all that behind, something like that. And I'd always missed Pat. He was a good friend. But I knew that his buddy Joe had reached out to me in 2005 about something I don't know what. And so I went through my old emails and found an email from Joe Benjamin, who at the time was living in Boulder, and just shot in the dark. He had given me his phone number in this email. Shot in the dark, I texted the phone number. Hey, Joe, it's John Roderick. If this is you, like, write me back. Didn't hear from him all day. And then at like 7 o'clock at night, the phone rings.
Rings. So you know it's a phone call.
Rings from a 303 area code, and it's Joe Benjamin. Well, I haven't talked to him, like heard his voice since 1989. He's the same guy. And I say, look, I'm sorry to just out of the blue you here, but did we go to East Berlin in July of 1989? And he said, yes. He said, we were in Zurich with our Eurail passes, and we're standing in the train station, and we don't know what we're going to do, because this was what we, you know, with the Eurail pass, you just go to the train station, you look up at the big board,
right?
And
the big board will tell you where everything's going. But did you remember was that surprising to you to go like, was that, for example, just that one fact, which is like, okay, John, I can give you a clue. We were there, A, and then B, it was preceded by being in Zurich. Does that help? Right.
Right. And it's one of those, like you were talking about, how did I get to Tampa that day?
Yeah, right.
Just hearing him and just talking to him, it starts to click into place. And some of these are stories that I've actually told over the years that the Legos had come unstuck. And he said a train pulled in, and the placard on it that tells you where it's going said Warsaw. And you said let's get on this train to Warsaw, and maybe they won't, maybe no one will notice. You know, this is, there was no sign the wall was coming down at this point. This was a Iron Curtain days. And he said, you said, let's just get on this train to Warsaw and see what happens.
Oh, so
we went.
Oh, like you. So he's saying you was your idea. I'm sorry. I just want to clarify. He's saying you're the one who wanted to take some kind of a big adventure. But am I gleaning that part of the adventure is if let's see what happens is like, yeah, there's a pretty good chance we're not going to actually end up there for a variety of reasons. But let's see what happens. We got a Ural pass. And is Poland covered by a Ural pass?
It is not.
Uh-huh.
Right. Poland would be on the other side of the Iron Curtain. Yeah, there's no Ural pass over there. But I was like, those brilliant flashes of being 20 years old where you're like, well, it says Warsaw right on it. And if it
I have an idea how we could build a treehouse overnight and make money. Let's get started. Wait, yeah. Did that happen? I think that happened.
I mean, not everybody getting on. You ever have
those projects when you're young and maybe a little intoxicated and you're like, but then somebody, 35 years later, you need a little help puzzling it back together.
Yeah. Like this is not a thing that I could have put myself back in standing in this tower. I could not have gone, oh, right. There was a train that said Warsaw. Like I had just lost that connective string. And so as he's telling me, I'm like, oh, right. And we rode the train across Germany. We went to sleep on the train and we woke up the next morning with guards in our cabin, army in our cabin, saying, what the hell do you think you're doing?
And
we were in the Alexanderplatz train station in East Berlin, and they were like, show us any sign of a ticket or a visa, any reason that you would be on this train still, because
is this a case of you sort of sleeping past your stop?
Yeah, yeah. We slept past whatever the stop was that said, if you're not a communist, get off this train now.
Right, right.
And so they pulled us off the train in East Berlin and said, you need to go down these stairs. And it had a catwalk with guards walking on it. Everybody in the train station was dressed in gray.
Like a catwalk at a prison?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
They were all looking at us, out of the sides of their eyes. They were like, get off the train, go down these stairs.
Over the years, I keep saying Stasi. I just want to point out that over the years, through a variety of exposures to a variety of TV and movie things, in some ways, the Stasi are up there now with Mossad. I didn't realize how much you don't want to mess with these guys.
Yeah, they're under your bed right now. What was that great movie where it was about East Germany and the Stasi?
I know what you mean. The one where the guy listens to calls. Not Eastern Promises, but I know exactly the one you mean. That's a really good movie.
Promises is the one where they have that fight. I think
that's where Viggo Mortensen fights in his altogether.
That's a great film. So we went back, but then we were in Berlin, and we were there in July of 1989. Because we'd
lives of others,
we'd taken this train.
The right? lives of others.
So then I said, the lives yep. of others, right? Yep. Great Sorry. Movie.
Yep.
So then I say to Joe, did we then get visas, go back across the wall, and go to the top of the giant radio tower and have a steak dinner? And Joe said, "Whoa, I have no recollection of that." But as I'm talking to him, I'm remembering, wait a minute, we did do this because we went across and they forced us to change West German Deutschmarks for East German Deutschmarks. And in the process of changing, and there was a mandatory amount, 100 Deutschmarks you had to change.
Mm-hmm.
And
to get in, to like show you had money to spend?
Yeah. Just like, you have to change this over. It's just a way of collecting Western money.
It's like Stalinist Disney dollars.
But then once we got out, once we got through the wall, and it was a whole elaborate, go through these corridors and stand and talk to very fierce-looking 24-year-old, blonde, square-jawed, angry soldiers. We got through, and right on the other side, somebody in a cloth hat sidled up to us and said, "You want to change some Deutschmarks on the down low? Because you guys just got ripped off in there. That's the mandatory amount."
Oh, and we were like, "Sure." Give you a better rate.
Yeah, so we gave him 50 Deutschmarks and got like 600 East German Deutschmarks on the black market. Uh-huh. So all of a sudden we had 700 Deutschmarks, and we're wandering
You've
around.
You've also already broken the law.
Six times, right? But
it's just at this point, it's just a question apart from all the things they could choose to make up about you, there's like six different things they could charge at this point.
And I have to imagine that the Stasi and the cops and everybody are watching us the whole time we're over there. I mean,
but this is the thing about Stasi. And like, at least this comes through in a lot of, again, this is media things I've read, but mostly media I've seen, is that like, you know, you've heard about this with the, what was it in the Cultural Revolution, the Red Guard, the young people who were like taking over with their radicalism, or to an extent the Hitler Youth, but like where you've gotten so much of a population to actively report on other people to the point where there's a benefit in even just a hunch being reported that gets blown into whatever because it serves a purpose, right? There's eyes and ears everywhere. That was my impression anyway of East Berlin. Even further toward the end, it got worse and worse and worse in terms of people reporting on each other, that there were eyes everywhere is what I've heard.
Well, and I have a friend, my sister's old high school buddy is like a charge d'affaires in the U.S. embassy in St. Petersburg. And they were out walking in the street, and Susan was saying, in St. Petersburg, Susan was saying like, "Well, so what's the deal with this?" And she said, "Look, we can't talk about this. Not in the apartment, not on the street, because there are people watching us now and listening to us. So anything we say while you are in Russia, you have to assume they're listening, and I'm in a position where I can't talk about it."
And it's not stuff that where you go like, "Oh, I understand why I'd get in trouble for that." Because again, like in a system, when a system gets like that, at least in my understanding of it, like it all just becomes, not compromise, but it all just becomes stuff that could be used for a purpose. If they've got you on tape somewhere saying, or a report of you saying a thing, and they need to round up 10 people tonight, you might be on that list. Because it wasn't that kind of how it worked. It was very, you don't like to say Kafkaesque too much, but like it's as bad as you think in terms of like the capriciousness of people, of citizens being used to make a point tonight.
That's why it's so great that there are thousands of hours of you and me talking without any breaks.
Yeah.
Online about everything. Because what can they do, Merlin? We've already said it all. We've already said every single thing you
said. That's what Steve Bannon calls flooding the zone.
We flooded the zone.
Yeah.
We flooded the zone before they even knew there was a zone.
Yeah.
Huh.
Okay.
So I remember walking around East Berlin, looking in the windows of, scare quotes, shops, and seeing that there was literally nothing to buy. We had 800 Deutschmarks or whatever it was, and there was not a single thing you could buy. Not even a kitschy, funny lunchbox that had a dancing bear on it or something. Not even a can of creamed corn East Germany.
Is this just because like there wasn't stuff? There was like supply problems?
Yeah, there was no economy, right? It was all just... I mean, I think if I were there now, I would see kitschy things that my 20-year-old
Michael lives in Berlin now, and it sounds pretty astonishing. Every photo he sends me, I'm incredibly envious. He's like, here's the thing from Wings of Desire. And I'm like, "You piece of shit." Yeah, no. You know that library in Wings of Desire? I'm like, "Yeah, I do really well." So yeah, that's there. I just go there when I feel like it.
That's the thing. It's an incredible city.
I've heard is like, again, pick your Berlin.
Yeah, it's so fantastic.
Okay, so tell me more about this story and how you clawed back your sanity.
Well, so now Joe is on the phone and he's like, I barely remember it, except for that was a story that really stuck in my head. That whole like, "Oh, we're getting on a train to Warsaw and see what happens."
Did you remember had you remembered that before and just misfiled it?
Yes. As soon as he said it, I was like, "Oh, right." Because I remember getting pulled off the train in that train station. Like that was an indelible memory of them saying, Like, not only are you not allowed to go, but you've already gone across. You should have gotten off at the last train station. You're on the other side now, and you're not allowed to be here, and you don't have any papers.
How can we just say in passing, which makes is going to make somebody look really bad?
Right.
Right. The fact that you made it past without, you slept through a border check or numerous border checks, or please, can I show me your papers? Somebody's going to get in trouble for sleeping at the switch on that one.
Probably. Right. Or maybe this is, I can't imagine it happens. I can't, because I think everybody else involved, all the people that would have normally been on that train, know it's so ingrained that no one would have ever failed to get off at the station before, right?
You're really trying to stay on past Coney Island, and you're like,
if you were a spy, like, this would be the last thing you would do. You know, you're not gonna,
right?
If you had any evil plan, this wouldn't have worked. But so I remember that. Then all of a sudden, in my like plowing through all the rooms in my head, I'm like, we had all this money. We couldn't spend it. We went into a pub.
Oh, my God. You had to find a place to spend money.
Yes. We were buying beers for everybody in the pub, and they were all like 50 pfennig a piece, and nobody in the pub wanted our beers. They didn't want us to buy them beers. They were like, no, thank you. Like, why are you here? Just being in this pub is putting us all in an uncomfortable position.
Because now this is like how Stalin killed the people returning from the Western, or their Western Front, which is, you know, right? It's like you had exposure to an American who broke the law. So we have a lot of questions for you.
Yeah, right. I mean, what are you in there drinking with that American about? You know, I don't know. They just were not, it was so ingrained in them that they were like, we have our own beer, thank you. And we were like, fuck, what are we going to do? Like, what? Because we couldn't stay overnight. The visa said you have to be back here at whatever time. And somehow I said, let's go to the big tower and see if we can blow some cash or some. And we went and they let us in, which seems, again, like the
is
only
it,
reason
is it
they
the
did is
Fernsehturm. Fernsehturm.
Yeah.
No, I like it. How do you pronounce it? Berliner Fernsehturm.
Well, that sounds.
But it looks. It's not. I don't want to say it's like exactly like the Seattle Tower, but it's got a spire at the top, and it's a radio tower. But it's really cool looking. And I have to say though, it's a little
bit. Fernsehturm.
Okay. All right.
Let's call it that. I don't remember shit. I was just there.
And it's near Alexanderplatz. Look at that.
Yeah, it's right there. And so somehow, I mean, again, like, how did I get to Tampa? I have no idea how I even knew there was a restaurant in there.
I know.
And how I convinced these two other guys. We were just, you know, we were sleeping in on the street the night before. And now we're at the top of this tower, like, gargoyle, more wine. And
gargoyle is German for garçon.
and Joe could not confirm it, could not remember this. And I'm like, look, I know this happened because I couldn't. There are too many details in my head to have made this up. And also, I've spent 2 weeks trying to track this memory down. And I'm at a dead end. And then Joe says, we need to call Pat. And I said, I haven't talked to Pat in 30 years. Pat stopped replying to everybody. And I'm talking about everybody that I went to college with. They're like, yeah, Pat.
Is he gone. From Gonzaga?
He went to Gonzaga. And Joe says, I'm still in touch with Pat. He's the one guy in the whole world that's still in touch with Pat. And I said, if you can get, first of all, if I knew you could get me on a text thread with Pat, I would have called you a long time ago. Not even about this story, about the Fernsehturm.
Yeah, man.
But this is going to be fun to get Pat spun up on this. Like, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. I'm going to hear the story. Someone else is going to tell me this story that only I have held for 35 years. Because this is not a story we never talked about it again, right? This is not some fun back and forth where you go to parties with your college friends and you're like, ha, 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 remember that time? Like, this has just been living in some increasingly small cave in my head. Let's get Pat on the phone. And Joe says, I am going to get Pat on this, but right now I'm going on a 3-day ayahuasca retreat.
Okay. Sort of Aboriginal buildings, Ramon.
So, and I said, really? Like, you know, right. you're okay.
How often is that a thing you do?
You're scraping your soul, huh? And he's like, yeah, I mean, you gotta do it. You gotta reset. Yeah, and I think he said, this time it's not actually ayahuasca. We're doing some other root that's called Mumu Chan or something. You know, it's called some kind of Chan. One of the Chan.
And enlightened ayahuasca, yeah.
And so here we are, Monday. Joe has had a soul scraping. He's back, presumably at work in Boulder. And I'm not sure what he does. He might be, I didn't think to ask him. I was too busy asking about East
Berlin.
Did things
end acrimoniously or was he like in witness protection? Not at all. I guess you could almost certainly say the same thing about me, which is like, I don't go out of my way to stay in touch with pretty much anybody. So like, but it wasn't seen as like, he's mad at you or something.
What happened was in Berlin in November of 1989, the wall came down. Joe and Pat and I sat up on top of the wall. We got a hammer and chisel. We chiseled pieces of the wall, which was very hard to actually chisel. Surprisingly hard.
It's a wall.
We were sleeping in, you know, we were partying and drinking with all these. The Germans were losing their heads, absolutely losing their heads. It was like a once in a lifetime for everybody there. We were just watching, basically, as the Germans had this moment with themselves. And we were there for, I don't know, 10 days of just steady. It was not a bacchanalia exactly, because it was winter, first of all, but also... it was like, I don't know. I'd never seen anything like it.
Things that just I've seen from videos and whatnot is like, people did seem like, I don't know, manic, but like really like the people, there was a lot going on. Was there just an atmosphere, like a crackling electric atmosphere of change, excitement?
Nuts. Yeah. You know, I went and saw the line of Trabants coming across, and the Trabants had...
Tell me what that is.
It's the little East German car, the little like putt, 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 putt East German car. It's a very signature little car of the Eastern Europe.
Okay.
It looks like a little Fiat 124. And the car can hold four people, but they had eight people in them. And they're lined up. And it's because it was the car of East Germany, the line was just all Trabants. So it's kind of a crazy image because it's just... It's like 40 versions of the same car, all lined up, crammed full of people. And people on the western side, as soon as they crossed over, they were like throwing money in the windows and opening champagne bottles and just handing them into the cars. Like they were just throwing Western treasures into the cars. Like, welcome to the West. Here are, like, would you all like watches? You know, just the idea... that separated them, West and East. The Western response, standing there, was just like this explosion of, look, wealth. Like, now you can have wealth. Now you, here are things. You don't have anything to buy on your side of the wall.
Yeah.
On our side of the wall, all we have is things to buy. It was insane. But Joe... and Pat and I were starting to splinter at that point. Pat wanted to go home. And I had met some German guy who lived in the Alps. Some kid who had spent some time in America. He spoke English. He'd done a foreign exchange. And he lived in Garmisch-Partenkirchen. And I'd been talking to him, and
I haven't had a really good John story with lots of foreign words in a while. And this is really taking me back to the early days.
And he said, I can get you a job as a ski instructor in Garmisch because there's a big American military base there.
You're going to have to fake your papers.
they all want to learn how to ski. Mm-hmm. And Joe, God bless him, Joe said, I'm not done. I'm going to Greece. I'm headed out. I'm not headed in. I'm not trying to find a job like in some German ski resort. I'm not going home. I'm going farther.
Wow.
And I remember at that moment feeling like, I want to go with Joe. I want that to be my future, that I keep going that way. But this guy, this friend who was like, come to my German village, he had a lot of weed. Mm. And he was like, we're going to party and we're going to be ski bums. And I split up with Joe and I went to Garmisch and I got there and spent 3 nights with this guy in the house he lived in with his mom. And his mom was like, who is this guy? Get him out of here. He's been here 3 nights and I was already tired of him after night one. And so he was like, I'm really sorry. You know, you can't stay here anymore, but don't worry. We're going to get you a job at the, the ski resort thing petered out. And then it was like, oh, the marker bindings factory, maybe it will hire you. And I went,
At this point, you're about to get human trafficked.
It was all very like, meh. And I went and actually had an interview with somebody at a company there. And the guy said, you know, a month ago, I would have hired you, but I don't know if you've noticed, there's suddenly a lot of people from East Germany here.
Oh, yeah.
Also looking for work, and they all speak German. So I think the job market's going to be
And their eyes aren't rolling freely in two different circuits.
Yeah. And they're not hippies, right? So, and I was like, right.
Yeah.
Then I had kind of dead-ended myself because now it was December. I'm in a German mountain town freezing to death. I got nowhere to go. And it's an expensive town. I can't afford to be there on my own.
Right.
And I had lost Joe. Joe had, because, you know, there's no, how do you get in touch with somebody?
You still have your pass at this point?
I still have the URL pass, right. Yeah. But Joe and Pat have split up. And what am I going to do? Send a postcard to Pat's mom to tell Joe's mom to tell Joe that I'm going to come find him in Greece? And I hit a wall of despair. Hmm. And it was Christmas time.
Oh, is this when you called your mom?
It was when I called my mom. Right, I'd been there for nine months at this point, and I was like, Mom,
yeah,
help, or whatever. And she was like, come home for Christmas. Hmm. Well, when I talked to Joe later, sometime in 1990, he had gone to Greece, had gotten a job in a bar on the beach in Santorini, had worked at like a beach bar all through the winter, and then continued on his journey, I think, to Turkey, and had done what I wish I had done.
Right.
And so
Good trajectory.
It was great. And I let myself get sidetracked. And when I think back to it, I honestly think I made that decision because this guy had a bag of weed.
I was going to ask. Like, is that how it feels in your head? Like, because knowing how you are, and if I could say, and how you will, as you say, chew on things, there must be a part of you, to state the obvious, that goes, I could have gone with my pal and ended up being one of the fathers in Mamma Mia. But no, I did this because there was a guy who said there'd be weed in Switzerland.
Yeah. I think that's what happened.
Yeah.
And
it's understandable.
It is, but.
But I mean, no, honestly, it's not ununderstandable. I mean, when you look back with the bright light of time on your side, as much as you can remember what happened, you still got to remember, like, you know, if we can't always decide on the day, in the moment, we don't always decide. There's no way to know if we decided the best thing. And if you didn't have your pals but wanted a little more adventure, and there's a guy that said, here's a warm place to shit, and I've got weed. I don't think it's insane for you to do that at age, whatever that was, 19? What was it?
20. Well, no, we had turned 21. We had all turned 21 at that point. We turned 21 in Europe that year. But What's interesting in talking to Joe?
Great, a new thing for you to regret. You need that. You need more of those.
But no, I'm thinking. So this has been very interesting because for 35 years, I have said you followed a bag of weed to Garmisch-Partenkirchen when you could have followed Joe to Santorini, and that was the road less traveled by, and it made all the difference, or whatever.
Yeah. Regular Kokomo.
But getting you back in touch with Joe, who's living in Boulder and going on a ayahuasca journey this weekend, and when he gets back, he's going to call Pat, and we're going to try and figure out if we went to the top of the Fürstenturm.
Yeah.
In Berlin.
Nürburgring.
It's wonderful in a way to know that, wait a minute, Joe did that, I did that, but here we are. Here we are back together. It's the same old thing we learn 1,000 times, which is Joe did not go on to become the deputy undersecretary of state for the nation of Greece. Joe's living in America, doing a thing. He's a middle-aged guy. He's got a teenage daughter. And I am too. And that decision that there's definitely 10 years of my life where it felt like a catastrophic misstep to have followed a bag of weed rather than to find the sun. It wasn't. It was just fine. It was just what I did, and he did what he did. You know, like part of being 55 is this marvelous feeling of like, wait, we all are still.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like none of the guys that I knew in 1995 who had record deals are markedly different from the people in 1995 who didn't have record deals. But they, at the time, we seemed like
somebody tried to tell you in 1993 what the, not the fate, I don't want to put it that way, but like everybody who was getting signed in an era where like the Posies could get signed, like, but like, you're like, well, you're going to be surprised to find out how a lot of this turned out because it didn't all turn out great. And that was not a brass ring. Like, right? Like, and in that same way, but like, and all we have is our memories and our regrets and our hopes. And I think it's not unusual to cobble those things together. And again, like even now, like not to, you know, rain on your parade, but it's like, even today with the four of you or however many having this nice conversation, it's still like, well, and that's still for now. Like that's just a snapshot of where we caught up to. Now I just realized that Bick and Ray we did that reunion show where we opened for the Wrens in Tallahassee in 2005. Yeah. And it had seemed like a million years between Bick and Ray ending in 1999 and us doing that show in 2005. We were all really different, had really different lives, but that was 6 years. And now that was 19
years ago.
Yeah. Almost 20 years ago. Yeah. It's one of those, I call them chronologies, where you try to take a period of time from the past, and you know what I mean, where you go like, it's been as long since X as from X to Y.
It's
a really, I find that a very calm, what you're going through right now, it's a fun story, but like, it's also a very complicated affair where you find yourself wanting or really needing to relitigate things you thought you understood from the past with the new context, don't you think? I think that's one of the most, for me, that's one of the most difficult parts. It can be one of the most, it can be so fun. I'm avoiding telling you a very long anecdote from last week. All you really need to know, I'll send you a photo, but I did a podcast with five friends of mine from New College talking, and they do a podcast about New College. And because they're from, like, includes my friend Grant, who I think you know.
I do know Grant.
Who's exactly from my class. And then some people from, like, anyway, but I described it as like opening a bag of hair that you only let yourself sniff every few years. Because you don't want it to stop smelling like hair. But then you also, then in that case, we're collaborating, the five of us. Well, what happened at the protest? What order did those things happen in? What was it really like when we were in the jail? Like, what was, and so everybody brings this, you know, kind of like temporal stone soup where everybody brings their pieces to it. And there's some things that everybody remembers pretty well. There's some things hardly anybody remembers. But then the best part is when two people will be able to like finish a sentence about something that happened. But that's, I don't know. I mean, look at. There's a lot of culture about that phenomenon, going back to the Greeks and all the way through Akira Kurosawa, about the different ways that we like put together the past. But it's sometimes really fun and it's enjoyable and it's nice to have a snapshot in 2024 of, well, we're all still alive and, you know, it hasn't gone horrible yet. But like, I find that very complicated because as soon as you start, it's almost like this incredibly complex series of gears to get you the machine that explains your past as of today. You can't just go in and move some gears around because that's not how gears work. Do you know what I mean? Another way to think of it, if you like in a more James Burke way, is like as a network of connections. You can't just go and change one of those connections without having an influence on all the other connections. And even in my own mind, such small things as like, was that a Perkins or a Denny's we used to go to where there's a waiter named Ken who would be the only guy working? And like, people remember different things about, you know what I mean? And you like collaborate on that. But I think it's a very complex and honestly a very emotional thing to do.
It is. And I've been really surprised at how emotional it's been trying to untangle it. And
I was on a podcast talking about getting arrested at a protest and I cried twice. It was like a 2-hour recording. It was so emotional to me to talk to these people who are still 19 years old in my head.
Well, and I think another thing that's crazy, because the other day I was looking at Instagram, of course, again, and I hit a wall because something, again, just subtly has changed. It's maybe not even that subtle, but something has changed where Instagram now is just feeding me this stuff, like the little video clips that it's like, do you want to watch this video of a train hitting a deer? Every one of those video clips now has a young girl with a big bosom jumping up and down about something and a little caption that says like, you won't believe it.
Yeah. Busty train fails.
And I don't the things that I click on to look at on Instagram are people trimming cow hooves and I bet you didn't know how many smokestacks have fallen on buildings in the last 20 years. Here's a site devoted to it. I have never clicked on a thing that had a young girl bouncing, but Instagram is like, I bet you'd like this, young girls bouncing.
Mm-hmm. They're trying to tell you something about yourself.
I hit a wall. I was like, this has
you ran out. You have that feeling where you're like, I've run out of internet. I've seen all the good internet. Right. I've run out of internet. I've run through this with things that I'd like to read. Where I don't really feel like reading a book. I don't even feel like reading a short story. But I would like to read what we used to call a long read. If I could find a good piece that's like a profile of somebody interesting, I would really enjoy that. And there'll be days where I'm like, I've run. I'm bloop 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 pulling down the thing. I feel like I've run out of internet, or I've at least run out of good internet.
I'm at the end of good internet. Is exactly what it feels like. And I'm scrolling. And it's just like everybody's trying to sell me.
Hey guys, I'm Busty Train Fails.
They're not trying to sell me anything in particular. They're trying to sell me themselves.
People don't even know what they're trying to sell anymore. It's all so confusing and complicated, and it keeps coming back to because ads. And you're like, well, but what are the ads for? Well, the ads lead you to other ads, and you're like, I don't understand. It's like we're like Wile E. Coyote running in midair, and we just haven't really looked down yet. I don't understand what is supporting in any way what all of this is nominally is.
Yeah. There's seven things that throw up in my feed every day that are like, hey, it's a cute girl with a British accent pronouncing the names of trees. And it's like, the first time I saw that, I guess I thought it was charming. I guess I looked at it too long. And now the internet thinks that I love girls naming trees. And there's seven different of those accounts. And I'm seeing them all. Anyway, I hit the end of the internet. Like you say, where I was just like, I'm so exhausted. And honestly, I'm also in the business of what? Trying to get people to watch me and listen to me? Like, oh my God, I don't even pronounce trees interestingly.
Yeah. Maybe you should do it on a trampoline or something.
And then I and then I
welcome to Bouncing John.
I compared that to this, which is an incredible if I had a picture of me and Joe and Pat at the top of the Fernsturm in 1989 with a plate covered with steaks with tons of people in the background in brown ties.
Maybe holding up the day's newspaper, holding up,
No, because it would just be the light bleed in the camera would show you how old it was.
Right.
If I had that one photograph, it would be a year.
Is that Taylor Dane? Is that Taylor Dane in the background? I mean,
it would just
Jane Child. Must be 1989.
There's not a 21-year-old in the world right now that's having an experience that they aren't documenting with 100 pictures.
Yeah.
And so to sit here and be like,
sometimes of people, but rarely.
but to sit here and think, did that actually happen? And can I find one of the five people that could even validate it to remember it too And to right now have talked to four of them, and there's only one remaining, and I haven't talked to him in 35 years. And he might also say, I was too drunk, I don't remember. Because there were seven other things that happened that day that crowded.
Aren't you also kind of dreading, what if somebody mentions, oh, and also there was a treasure map and you weren't interested? Is there some part of you that's like, I can't take any information that makes me feel worse about myself?
Well, all of this, in a weird way, is making me feel better about myself for the reasons that you were saying.
Continuity, which is, man. Just like you've always been the same person. And to quote the great Elaine Stritch, I made it through all of last year and I'm here. Like, that's who you are. You are, in some ways, the sum or multiplicatively the product of those experiences. And whether you remember them or not, like, you know, I mean, there's a lot of ways to look at it that are really wholesome. But you're also getting at something that, I won't change the topic, but like, Instagram and things like it, I don't want to say anything about other people. I will say this about myself. But things like Instagram and other things, they don't have an appeal to me because I feel a very sick and venal performance going on. Mm-hmm. And if you're for myself, and again, I'm old, fine, write this off, everybody. Don't worry. Act like this is not true because I'm old. But like, if I found myself in a position, as I have from time to time, wanting to like conduct my life in ways that would make for good internet photos, or to like show that I was rich but not stuck up, or that I had good feet but like I didn't put them up too much. You know, you have to like, there's so many lines you have to walk. You can never please everybody. The more popular you get, the more people will hate you. And all that stuff, I can't imagine. I would go from being a beautiful glass to a pile of sand very quickly. That stuff is absolutely excruciating to me. And I've learned to not even talk about it because it makes me sound like one of the hill people. But I don't understand how I would be able to straighten out that swing into a home run in such a way that like that I would find myself constantly thinking about, I don't know. I mean, I probably just don't understand. And that's my role. My role is to reach a certain point where I just don't understand. That's what we all do. Hopefully you can do it with class, but it does not change the fact that like, so that call with my friends, including one of my dearest friends, Grant, like included stuff like, and you know, I said like stone soup, which is an overused phrase, but like, for example, we found ourselves talking about, four of us had been in different bands together. And by which I mean different bands. Grant and I had been in a bunch of them. I'd been in the Fauves. Grant and I had done solo stuff together, like a duo thing where we played at a coffee house on Fridays. And like, but then Grant and Christian, who by the way, was at a gig in Madrid that night. So that guy in the picture in the lower left, he started 2 years after me, my friend Christian, and he's a professional bass player. So he was playing stand-up bass at a gig in Madrid. That's his wife, Megan. Uh-huh. They have a 22-year-old son who's a physicist. A kid who started school 2 years after me, and I didn't know Megan super well at the time, but yeah, one of my good pals has a 22-year-old son who's a physicist.
Wow.
That one fact alone is...
I gotta also say, I really like your beard.
I don't know where I'm going with this, but thank you. It really exaggerates my jaw.
You look like somebody on a space station that's been living there a long time, and the new astronauts show up, and they're like, hello, hello.
Is this my future? But like, hello? In that, a very specific example, I got a wonderful email yesterday from Megan. And because we talked about like the different band stuff, and everybody has like a little piece of the stone soup, and they just don't know it until somebody says, we're having stone soup tonight. So I was able to pull up the Facebook from 1986. Well, you know, I don't know if you had this. Did you have Facebooks at your school? Like when you went to college, where they would take a photo of everybody with their name, and like, it's kind of like, for example, it's ironically enough, it's kind of what led Mark Zuckerberg to create Facebook, was that he could go and get all the photos of freshmen. Like, although, you know, all the first year students.
It was a yearbook.
I'll send you a photo.
It came out at the end of the year, right?
Well, no, this is the Facebook, which was just so you can keep track of who all the new students are. Here's a bunch of silly photos of them. So I had that to contribute. I had a PDF of that to contribute. Several people had photos that some of us were in, and I forgot that I was at, so Christian had organized a visit to campus by, I don't know if you know the name, Ivan Stang, the guy from the Church of the Subgenius. And I forgot that I was temporarily overnight married to everybody else at New College by Ivan Stang. And there's a picture of me and the woman who would become my first wife, as well as a bunch of these idiots, I forgot that event even happened, but somebody mentioned it and Megan's like, yeah, I got a photo of that. Another one is like a flyer for this thing where a bunch of bands played. My band was the quote headliner. Another one of like our fixed ska band, Dog School, the Christian and Grant and I. But what I'm saying is each person is like, oh yeah, I've got something from that. Here's a clipping from when our friend took his life. Here's a photo of the arrest, the day of the protest that I was arrested at. It's just, there's no way. I'm sorry, this is so obvious, but I felt it very deeply that there is this partially shared, partial past that we all have that we can all contribute to. We've all had lives before and after that, but there's something special about getting together with people and being able to like pull your potatoes and your carrots. And, yeah,
that's the thing. You've known them for 40 years or 35 years.
And Grant's the only one I keep in anything like touch with. I mean, Grant and Michael and Dennis are like my three best friends from that time in numerous ways. Grant's at least the longest lived, like kept in touch friend. But like, I don't.
Grant pulls my ass from the fire all the time, by the way.
In what sense? He's really smart, you know?
He's really smart. And there are so many things I don't understand. That I
he's
don't
really
talk to
he's
John
okay.
Syracuse
he's
about.
Okay. Yeah. He taught me about Sid Barrett and Gnosticism, and he did his thesis on hermeneutics. And he's a really interesting guy.
Hermeneutics.
Yeah, it's a great word. Isn't that a good word? But like, I don't know. It's just I'm not sure what my point is, except that like like the saying Equus, moments snap together like magnets. You never know when this. We all have these weird little shared these little pools of memory that we share with other people, and sometimes we refine them and sometimes they can be painful, but it's, can I just do one quick one that's kind of funny? I wasn't even going to mention this because who cares, but like toward the end of The Call, which was very long, and this is for a podcast they do about New College, and toward the end, Grant was like, when you texted me today, because I hadn't texted him in a while, I texted him at two phone numbers that had the same area code. I don't think I'm blowing up his spot at all here. You know about what Grant used to do for a living, right?
Yeah.
So Grant goes, yeah, you texted me at the phone number I've had forever on my phone, but there's a pretty good chance your other text, we should start a new channel. There's a pretty good chance your other text just went to somebody who works for David Pecker. And I said, of course, I did. Because Grant used to be... I know he was an editor for the Weekly World News for a long time, but I think he was like a major domo editor at the Weekly World News. If you're listening, Grant, hi, I love you. And yes. And I was like, wait a minute. So like, and by the way, that was the first witness in Trump's trial today in New York. The first person on the stand today was David Pecker from AMI. AMI is the company that owned the National Enquirer. They did. Yeah. So he's like, let's start a new thread because you might be texting a phone owned by David Pecker. That's just I make that crack a lot about that movie and play Equus, moments snap together like magnets, but that is inextricably how it feels to me sometimes. It's the kind of thing like, I don't know if anybody's gone back and watched Amelie lately, but because Amelie became a little bit of a punchline as a movie, but a couple things to remember about Amelie. First of all, it's better than you even remember. It's a very good movie. It's also not as sickly sugar sweet as you remember. Like no, Amelie's got, it's got edges to it.
Yeah,
but it do you remember that like, and this is such a hallmark of like European art house cinema, into the 2000s, whether this is like Run Lola Run or whether it's like Wings of Desire, whatever. There's a line that runs through a lot of great European art house stuff, which is like, look at this insane sequence of events that nobody had any idea had anything to do with each other at the time, and this happened and then this happened. And of course, I'm also watching James Burke's Connection series right now. So I'm learning about how pasta led to the creation of gunpowder or whatever. This is on my mind. And it's made me intellectually and emotionally vulnerable in the sense of we gloss our way through a lot of our day-to-day chunking. Like the sand psychology, the phenomenon of chunking information and like heuristics and biases, not the bad kind of biases, but just the kind of biases we all have of like, well, I don't go to that neighborhood because I heard it's dangerous. We have all these things and that's how we have a quiet life, right? But like there are times when something kind of punches through and you're forced to like have the sort of a second order thinking where you go like slow think your way through this thing that happened with other people. John, it was really overwhelming, and I wasn't the only one who got at least a little emotional talking about it, because I'm talking to people that went to the same squirrely school as I did, all have just, they're so smart and have such extreme intellectual curiosity, and something I really miss, John, I'm not going to talk a lot about it, but like they get subtlety and context. And having a conversation about the past with people who are not willing to just accept, you know, the party line on something, but to go like, yeah, and you know what? And I can remember at that time, I was really sad because I broke it up with someone and had a really bad trip. And they're like, oh, I do remember that. And they, blah, blah, blah. And then I come out of that and I'm back into the world. And it's just I don't want to use the word plastic exactly, but after an experience like that, in the same way as like, I don't know, I don't want to make it weird, but like watching somebody who's ill die or like reconnecting with somebody from your past, those kinds of things, you get dropped back into the world as it is. And it's a very complicated feeling. I wonder if you get this, like after your experiences with this group of guys, doesn't it feel kind of odd to then be expected to go watch Busty Train Fail? You're like, oh no, that's right, we're still doing this. I'm back here with these folks who are like, you know, intricately, subtly interrogating what it meant when you took this class rather than that class, and like, oh yeah, that's right, that breakup did end kind of badly. You know what I mean? I admit some of that could just be the misty watercolored memories of the way we were, sure, but I don't think I'm just pining for the fjords. I think this is something very real where you're like, oh, I've just reconnected with a time that was very important in my life. Why, you know, if you ever want to cheer yourself up, listen to a band you love when you're 15. End of story. It's going to blow your mind. Most of the time, if you go and listen to a band you love when you were 14 to 18, it'll make you happy. Because that was maybe a happy time in your life, or it was at least an emotional time. I was thinking the other day, yesterday, literally last night, how Mexican Wine, or really Fountains of Wayne in general, Welcome Interstate Managers, I associate that album so closely with two extremely difficult moments in my life. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, hearing Mexican Wine, he was killed by a cellular phone, hearing that line begin and that guitar calms me, centers me, because it takes me straight back to two times that fucking album helped me through two very difficult times. Wow. That's what we're, right? Isn't that what we're really talking about? This is like the real stuff of life. This is not like getting a photo of your feet on your friend's boat. This is real shit. And like, we forget the importance, the impact of this in our parents. We can't do it all day long, or you'd be a nut. You'd be like the three-eyed raven losing your goddamn mind. No, but like when you get reattached to something that is valuable and you can have an experience today with people, I don't know what I'm saying. Get my back.
Well, that's the thing.
Isn't this a big deal, though, when you do this? And it's, you get a kind of reverse culture shock coming back to where we are today in some ways.
When I was talking to Joe, you know, he called me. Freaking called me.
On a phone, like a person.
What the fucking called me? And I realized, I'm so glad he called me. If I had been doing this over text with him, like I did with Dolph, I had a side-by-side comparison. I texted back and forth with Dolph. I don't know what Dolph sounds like now. I didn't have a moment with him. He reminded me that he'd actually come to see the Long Winters play when we played in Atlanta. And I talked to him and we'd had a great time after the show. But, you know, we were on tour and I'd forgotten, right?
Yeah,
forgotten that I'd had that moment with him. I wished I'd called him. You know, I wish I'd called him. But I'm on the phone with Joe, but it's 7 o'clock at night. I'm standing out in front of an Italian restaurant. I told everybody else, like, go on in. I'll be right there.
Get your scabetti. I'll be in a minute.
I'm talking on the phone to Joe, and I finally say, hey, you're on your ayahuasca journey. I've got to go in and get some pizza for the table. But I just want to say, like, Joe, you still sound like yourself.
I know.
You sound like Joe.
Yeah.
Do I sound like me? And he said, you absolutely sound like John. Hmm. And it was such a...
How'd you feel about that?
It was such a gift, you know? It just felt so reassuring, mm-hmm. because...
Doesn't it make you feel just a tiny bit sturdier as a being?
It was very emotional because because that person and me, how are they? How can they possibly be connected? I've been through 1,000 psychic wars. And Joe has too.
Yeah. Yeah,
he
yeah.
scraped his soul an uncountable number of times.
That's why
on his way back to
taking the journey.
He might be selling articulated hose. I don't know. Next time I talk to him, I'm going to ask him what the hell he does for a living.
Yes, but okay, sorry. Go.
But the fact was, I needed to hear that I was the same person.
Oh shit! Yeah,
and that
you didn't go into it thinking about.
No. He was like, "You sound like you."
Yeah,
and I was like, "I'll talk to you later."
See, okay, I gotta grab that one though, because I have this thought that I am not proud of. And if I wanted to perform as a different kind of more palatable person to you, okay, so I'm about to say something untrue. That's what I would say if I wanted you guys to like me, which is this. And the amazing part was, it was just like no time had passed at all. And we talked to each other, and it was incredible. And we agreed that from now on, every 5.5 weeks, we're going to have a group call, and we'll start a text, and like none of us have changed. And it's all the same. Okay, that's what I would say if I wanted you to like me. But because I hope you understand me more than like me. What I'm going to say is this. I have no intention of doing any of that with anybody ever. Because the times that I have, as a rookie, old person, at the age of like 30, done that in the past, reconnecting with my second best friend from childhood, who was the son of our minister, who I sang with, like he discovered, or he learned that I was out there from stuff I did in my, you know, productivity
sure.
guy job.
You were Merlin Mann on the internet.
He contacted me. It's like, it's Eric. I'm like, Eric? He's like, yeah. Last time I saw Eric was when he and his mom were visiting Florida in like 1981. But I had 4 very intense years of him being my second best friend. Like, we went to school together. We sang, like I said, all this stuff. And I think at the time I said to Eric, there's some usual jazz about, maybe I can get my company to bring you here. And I was like, oh, it's just nice to catch up. But I was like, but we should really stay in touch. Here's the thing. Yeah, maybe we should really stay in touch. Maybe what you really would like to say is we really should have stayed in touch. I don't agree with, personally, I don't agree with that either. I differ from you, I think, here. I have stopped saying that to people, and it keeps these experiences much more real and fresh to me, because we don't end it all by going, yeah, so anyway, let's get lunch. I'm not saying I don't want to talk to you again, but it gets to be more special if we all walk into this chamber for a minute and see that we're all still here and we talk about this, then we walk out of that chamber and have whatever life we were going to have anyway. If the life we were going to have anyway is to keep talking to each other like we have for 40 years, you two, that's fine. Like, you know, can you not see that for your group of friends? Like, I feel like there's something so sour that so sours the beauty, the sublime nature of an experience like this. Like going, okay, so anyway, friend me on Facebook, or let's make a plan that none of us has any intention of keeping, of always making sure that we look at the moon. No, it's just, and I'm not saying I don't like these people. If anything, I'm saying, Jesus Christ, I love these people so much, but they're a bag of hair. I don't want to smell the bag of hair so much that it no longer smells like what it used to be. I know that's a gross example, but you know what I mean. If you talk about a dream too much, it stops being the same dream. If you start telling the story too much, anybody can tell you, friends of John can tell you, that story is really different than it used to be because you've gotten reactions over time and changed it. I don't want to diminish this thing and what it was. And if I am going to like interrogate this with a friend or talk about it or discuss old times, I'd like it to be just as fresh as this felt right now. And you're not going to have that. Happily ever after is not always happily ever after. And boy, you know what I don't need is another fucking text group of people I don't actually know that well anymore. And
can
I don't
you believe
think
what's going on in the White House?
Can I believe what's going on in the White House with the Bidenomics?
Well, I went to dinner last night. The admissions director at my daughter's school, after we'd been going there a little while, sidled up to me at some event and said, I actually went to Gonzaga. I was a few years behind you, but my husband is Matt. And
did that instantly mean something?
And I was like, Matt?
Matt? Eric?
I know. I mean, you know, she has a last name too, but.
Yeah.
And I was like, no way. And she was like, yes. And he and John Barnhart are best friends. Well, John Barnhart and I were very close. And I knew Matt, and I knew that he and John were friends. But, you know, like, this was one of those things where I was a member.
You're
of
not reading group. The trades. You don't keep up with this.
I was a member of 10 groups, and I went on. And
whoever can tolerate me this week.
Yeah, right. I'm like, oh, I've got to go to another party. I'll be back soon. And so the other day, she invited us to dinner. Hey, come over to the house. We have a little wood-fired pizza oven. We're going to make pizzas. We all have teenage kids. And you haven't seen John in a long time. Although, you know, he and I are in more regular contact, but we haven't seen each other in several years. No, that's not true. He came to one of the Long Winter shows recently. But I hadn't seen Matt in forever. And so we had one of these that you're talking about, a dinner where I knew these guys from 35 plus years ago. And we all have friends, or we all have family, and we're all living in the same town. And we've never seen each other.
It's so interesting because you've all got, like, you've got loose connections with a lot of specific things. And when you press at that a little bit, you find more connections. And that can be so fun, so entertaining.
It's really fun. And, you know, and John and I briefly went into one of those things where he was like, remember that class that we took where the guy kept saying for also neither must? And I was like, I wrote it down in my notebook. Ha ha ha. And he's like, yeah, remember? And then we took this other thing. And he and I got into a very brief little like, and then we looked around and no one else, like, this was, we were just talking about something from freshman year that really bonded us, but that we were doing that thing. Like, no, don't you guys go off into your, like, remember that, you know, like get back in the room. But what's crazy is I've been to enough funerals lately where I realize that, there's not an unlimited amount of time. Like that bag of hair.
Yeah.
On the one hand, I don't want to smell the bag of hair until it doesn't smell anymore. But on the other hand, I don't want to save the bag of hair until
that's actually a really good point. This is adjacent to my advice that stickers are for sticking. You do not win awards for dying with good stickers. You simply use the stickers when you feel like it. Eat the big piece of chicken. Have dessert first. I know I sound like Warren Zevon or something, but
you sound
it's
like
really
an Instagram account.
Oh my God, secrets, you guys. Hey guys.
10 secrets to smelling the hair.
Seven takeaways to steal my look. Smell this hair.
Eat the dessert first.
Oh Jesus, I'm sorry. No. Don't talk to me before my Instagram pillow.
I just hope you say something nice at my funeral.
I'm not going up there for that. Fuck that. Even if you had it in the sunset, I'd go. Well, it depends.
What if some cool bands played, huh?
Do you have a rough idea when it would be?
I bet you there'd be cool bands. I mean, maybe not like...
I don't know. I'm not Wayne, that... But. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that would be... Yeah. We were talking about... The lines in your head, the ridiculous things. I mean, this is even beyond the purview of the Merlin podcast universe, probably, but lines that are just indelible. As far as I'm concerned, all you new waivers are in purgatory. Like these lines that somebody said and you never forget. And there's one where I was like, so I was kind of testing people for each person. I had like items where I was like, Christian, do you remember when you wanted us to call you Lando and you said that you wanted to get ground effects and paint the bottom of your car to say Lando's ride? And he's like, and Megan, who was very serious and still is very, Megan goes, he still wants people to call him Lando.
Wow.
And it's like, that's the same person. You know what I mean?
Wants people to call him Lando.
But like this one made me so happy. We were so, you know, the campus cops on our campus were really cool. And except for one guy who was a real, real pain in the ass, the four other cops on campus had all uniformly had like serious jobs in serious police work and then retired to Florida and became campus cops. And they really, they protected us. Nice. They were pretty cool. They were nice guys. They did their job. They scared away weirdos on campus. But they were retired guys. But one of the guys who had actually worked on a boat in New York dragging the East River. Like he'd had a career. And there's one time we were getting ready, some called PCPs, Palm Court parties, four times a year. We were getting ready for like a big, you know, event and like getting everything ready. And I think my friend Dan had stolen some lumber and was trying to make a tiki bar. And there was all this stuff going on. And one of these cops walks by and said something. And I said, Grant, do you remember what he said? And he said, I think I remember. I said, it starts out, big party. And Grant goes, big party, gonna break all the windows. And we both said it exactly like that because it was so fucking funny in 1988 that a cop, he didn't even break his gate, didn't look at us, just walked by and just goes, big party, gonna break all the windows. That's lived in my head since 87, 88, 89. And then you get to reconnect and somebody else remembers that too. Or, you know, the waiter that we thought had a hair weave. Or like all this insane stuff and what Grant calls the kenning, where you're going like, oh, which Amy? Is it Snake Amy or is it Goth Amy? We're like, it's a small enough camp. We all remember the time the Snake Amy warmed up a dead gerbil for her snake in the Second Court Lounge and it came back to life and its eyes bulged out. Yeah, of course everybody remembers that. Second Court Lounge was really gross. It's really moving. But
you know, there are some friendships, a lot of people's friendships are based only in that. right, where they get together and they talk about.
Oh, as in, like, do you remember that time that
we. Oh, remember that time that we were all. And every gathering is like that. And I have dropped out of so many friend groups, you know, like potential friend groups, because it was always like our present was always talking about that crazy thing we did.
Almost like just talking about like high school sports victories or something.
Yeah, right. And what you're describing is absolutely kind of, you can only do this one more time.
The most mundane thing that happened one day and you still remember it.
When you're 75 and you all get together to break open that bottle of cognac that you bought in 1915.
What's that called, a tontine?
You can do it one more time, right?
Uh-huh,
but
yeah.
Like, please do not remind me of that ski trip between now and then, because I can't live in a place that's defined by those. Yeah. It's wonderful to get back together and have everybody repeat that same, like, phrase that somebody misspoke, you know, but to have it be still like defining like our friendship. This is what we have. We don't it's not like we're building anything, right?
And pretty soon it feels like you're just kind of like almost like, remember that terrible, I'm sorry, this is gonna sound extremely weird, but you remember when there was that painting of Jesus that someone had single-handedly tried
the lady
restore.
In Spain.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that kind of what it feels like sometimes? Where you're like, I'd rather have this busted ass crack painting that barely looks like the painting anymore than spend like my precious hours today with y'all trying to like renovate it to a way that we want it to look.
Yeah,
that bums my head.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, in rock and roll, it's really easy. It's so fun too to sit around and be like, "What was that band that Larry Steiner would put the bass in the toilet?" But you know, right now,
well, I kind of want to hear that one. Capo right was now, real.
Right now, Mike Squires is playing in Ugly Kid Joe. He's the bass player of Ugly Kid Joe.
They had a hit, right?
Yeah, they did. But they're still massive in Europe.
Is that She Don't Like Me, but She Sure Likes the Bone? Was that them?
Something like that. I don't know. It was something that I did not.
Which I don't know. Oh, wow.
It was grunge era. But they do tours of Europe where they sell out, you know, they're selling 2,000 tickets a night. People in Europe still love Ugly Kid Joe, and they bought all the
records. That's work, man. That's, you know. Yeah,
they bought nine Ugly Kid Joe records, and it's still a big thing. But right now, Ugly Kid Joe is opening for the Scorpions in Vegas.
Oh, how many? Is Klaus Minus in it still?
It's Klaus Minus. It's all the guys from the Scorps.
Got a shanker.
And they're playing. And they're
doing all the Scorps.
They're doing like.
Speaking of Germany.
It's a residency. A Scorps residency in Vegas.
Well, they don't want to walk a lot, probably. Yeah.
You know, that's right. It's at the Planet Hollywood. They walk down from their suite upstairs. They go right. There's an elevator. Takes them right to the stage, probably. And Squires says, well, you're going to come down, right? You're going to come down to Vegas and watch me open for the Scorps, right?
Bow, bow, and bow. I was like, I can't wait for the nights with you.
Well, but the thing was, I was just in East Berlin.
I know.
And I was trying to show my daughter, like, well, here's what that looked like. And everything on the internet was like,
I'm going to tell you about a guy named Udo Dirkschneider.
You want to see the wall come down? Well, what you
get the balls to the wall. The
Scorpions. You want to watch the Scorpions video?
Uh-huh.
Whatever that was, some massive hit that they wrote about the wall coming down that I don't remember because I was on drugs at that point.
Yeah.
And so I showed her this Scorpions video.
I had so bounced on the Scorpions by 1989.
And there they were, and it was the wall coming down. So yeah. I have Scorps on the brain, and then Squires is like, what the, you know, WTF, I'm in Vegas opening for the Scorps and you're not going
to
buy.
Oh, what a nightmare that sounds like. Down? Oh, sure. Well, I'll just come on down to Las Vegas, which is an awesome place to be for more than five minutes.
Amazing place.
Oh, Jesus.
But I said to myself, yes, you absolutely have to fly down to Vegas, spend the night at the Excalibur and watch Ugly Kid Joe open for the Scorpions. Every one of those things is a thing you don't want to do.
Oh, I get it. This is a zone thing.
Yeah, stacked together.
Yeah.
Every one of those things you don't want to do.
It's a reverse gestalt.
You really don't want to do. You really don't want to fly to Vegas. You really don't want to stay at the Excalibur.
No. By the way, it was Deadeye Dick does the song New Age Girl, which includes the line, she don't like meat, but she sure likes the bone. Ugly Kid Joe is opening for the Scorps in a residency. Yeah.
That's right.
Las Vegas.
I know one of the guys, so I got a good seat. That doesn't mean I'm going to meet Klaus Meine.
No.
But I might pass him in the elevator or something, you know. But yeah, but even so, I got to go do it. I have to, because I don't want to, I don't care about the time Larry Steiner put the bass in the toilet at the off-ramp. Yeah. I care about tomorrow, Merlin. I care about tomorrow.
Oh, my gosh.
Do I still sound the same?
Yes, absolutely.
You still sound like Merlin.
The bitch is hungry. She needs to chill. Give her inches. Feed her well. Feed her well.
Yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm. What do you mean? What's wrong with being sexy?
There's nothing wrong with being...
There's nothing wrong with being sexy.
They all had cold sores. John, Jesus Christ.
Sir Eaton Hogg.
Sir Dennis Eaton Hogg. And so let's tap into America. We want to keep doing that? We can do that for a while. Yeah,
we could. I'm just as God
made me, sir.